I want to welcome you all to the New Drugs Symposium at this year's union meeting. As you can see, it's being co-sponsored by the Stop TB Partnerships Working Group for New Drug Development and the TB Alliance. I'm Ann Ginsberg. I'm the head of clinical development at the Global Alliance for TB Drug Development, the TB Alliance. And I'm particularly pleased to be co-chairing this symposium with Dr. Narayanan, who's director of the Tuberculosis Research Center in Chennai, India, one of the leading TB research institutions around the world and certainly a leader in clinical trials for TB drugs. Dr. Maria Freire sends her regrets. She's both the chair of the New Drugs Working Group and president and CEO of the TB Alliance, and had hoped and expected to be here to make some welcoming comments, but unfortunately has been hit by a bug and will be heading home in a little while and was unable to make the meetings, but asked me to be sure to welcome you all on her behalf and sends her regrets. I'm going to ask the speakers to try about 15 minutes so that we'll have time for at least one or two clarifying questions after each presentation, and then some time for more general discussion and question and answer session at the end of the symposium. So we will be pretty strict with the time limits for everyone. And now I'll ask Dr. Narayanan to introduce our first speaker.
Good morning, all of you. The first speaker of today's session is Dr. Martino Laranzi, who is a clinical trial expert. He spent 25 years in Merck Company and managed protocol development and implementation for a wide range of projects. Before joining Merck, Dr. Martino Laranzi was an academician at Northwestern University. He is currently with Global Alliance overseeing clinical trials. And we have the pleasure of handing over the podium to Dr. Laranzi to deliver his presentation on overview of the TB drug pipeline.
Dr. Narayanan, Dr. Ginsberg, colleagues, it's indeed an honor to be here in front of this distinguished audience today to present to you about the pipeline of the TB drug development and the especially focusing on PA24 and moxifloxacin. The pipeline, I'm sure you're all aware, all familiar with the term. It's a technical term that defines the complex process through which a product goes from the early phases of discovery through a complex set of a series of experimentations all the way, hopefully, down to the patients in the field. There are a lot of gaps, a lot of things that can go wrong along this path, and a lot of effort, a lot of hard work that goes with the development of each new product, and you certainly are aware of that because you are the guys who work along those lines. Pipelines are complex things, and I guess you don't take my word, here is the pipeline for the Global TB Research Projects, as it has been put together by the Working Group on TB Drugs. I certainly apologize for the small font, and I have to reassure you I don't want to go into any detail other than in a couple of these programs. But the points I want to make with this slide is that, well, first of all, I just said pipelines are complex things, and they are divided in basically in several different steps. They go from the basic research to early discovery through preclinical and clinical phases. Now, each one of these steps, as you know well, takes years, and each one of these steps is fraught with different kind of problems. One important thought is that there is absolutely no guarantee that one product will make it to the next step. Quite on the contrary, I found some interesting statistics from Script that you can see here that tell you the probability that a product has to make it from the stage where it is, and we're looking at preclinical here, which is basically this stage down here. Only 10%, only 1 in 10 will make it to market. And the probabilities increase as the phases, the products grows to the various phases of clinical research, But it's important to keep in mind that there's never, not even at the time of submission, the certainty that the product will make it. And the reason I'm making this point is because this obviously means that the fuller the pipeline is, the greater are the chances that we will indeed have some good products coming out of clinical development and into man, to the patient. Additionally, we need to keep in mind that we are dealing differently from normal pharma life, if you wish. We're dealing with combination regimens, which makes the things even more complicated. And that is the reason why the discovery part of the pipeline needs to be always full. And we are gladly and gratefully acknowledge the recent investment of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in the Accelerator Program, which I believe is $40 million dedicated to keeping this part of the pipeline as full as possible. Final point on this slide is that to keep in mind that 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, this would have looked much, much different, and this slide would probably could have been in certainly in much larger font with one or two entries, if at all. So moving on, I thought that I would focus now only on, actually you see down here, I'm sorry, but I will go back for a second. You see down here several projects, about a dozen projects in clinical. I will focus only for my next part of my presentation only on the projects that are in registration or aiming at registration of those products. And the list is much shorter, the font much bigger, and I will basically cover a couple of these in more detail, but you will hear a lot about these products later by other presenters. I have them listed in order of advancement, if you wish, going from the phase 3, and you will hear about the gatifloxacin by Dr. Bionard, I think, later. You will hear more about the moxifloxacin from me in a little while, and which is at the border, if you wish, between phase 2 and phase 3. You will hear about the J&J compound by Drs. McNeely and Diacon. You will hear Dr. Matsumoto presenting you about the Otsuka product. I will say a little more about 824, and while the other two products, Lupin product is completing phase 1, and the latest entrant is Sequela with SQ109. So that basically, it gives you a general overview of where we are, where the pipeline for TB products that are past the clinical phase, that are in that range that I showed you earlier, going from 20 to 65% chances of success is comprised of. And as I said, we will be focusing on A24 and moxifloxacin. So let me start with PA24 nitroimidazole. As you know, this is a compound that the Global Alliance has rights for, and we are developing on a rationale that is summarized on this slide. Product has shown a potent bactericidal activity both against replicating and static mycobacteria. It has a novel mechanism of action, is active against MDR strains of the mycobacteria, and has a narrow spectrum of activity. Like most of the products in development, the data, some of the key data about it come from Professor Grosset's laboratory, and you see here a study carried out in over 16 weeks. During the first 8 weeks, you can see in different colors different treatment combinations, and in orange you can see PA24 and a combination of azonizid and PA24 in white. Showed not much different from isoniazid alone, and further the continuation phase again showed that there was no significant difference between the two treatments, rifampin and isoniazid versus PA24. we are fully aware, as you are aware, of the recent, more recent data published by Drs. Nuremberg, Rosé et al., showing that, in fact, in further studies, that the when treated for 6 months, the relapse rate in mice has not shown difference, or was similar in mice treated with the PA24 and with the standard regimen. So certainly there's more, and that was with the concluded in the abstract that was presented at this meeting, and in other works, that there's need to for more work, and we certainly have followed that path. In fact, in order to take this product towards registration, we have already started phase one, and that's going to be the next part of what I'm going to talk to you about on this slide, where I have summarized the four clinical studies that we have been conducting so far. They will be summarized, each one, each study in one of the columns. And I will start with Protocol 001, which was a single-dose study, with which we treated patients, subjects from a dose of 50 milligrams per day, single dose, to 1,500 milligrams per day, single dose. It was done on 53 males, and the results were encouraging. The product proved to be well tolerated without dose-limiting adverse events or any abnormal lab results. We saw no effects on ECG, on vital signs, or on physical examination, and the Tmax proved to be about between 4 and 5 hours with a half-life of about 18 hours. We moved then to a multiple-dose study for 7 days, 24 patients, this time males and females, were treated with a protocol that considered treating from 200 to all the way to 1,400 milligrams per day, as I said, over 7 days. The issues that we saw with the 200 and 600 milligram dosage were confirmed what we had seen with the previous study. However, we saw in the 1,000 milligrams per day an increase in serum creatinine, which, as you know, is an indicator of renal activity, renal function. And curiously and interestingly, first of all, there was no consequence. I mean, it was perfectly reversible when the patients were washed out after the study. And at the same time, during the study, there was no effect, no consistent effect on VUN, blood urea nitrogen, which is another indicator of renal function. So we decided for that reason to not to enroll the 1,400 milligram cohort and do a study which I will show you, CL005, which I will show you in a minute. The Tmax was confirmed, and the half-life, again, considerably long, about 17 hours. 004 was an ADME study, which was carried out with an oral solution of radio-labeled PA24. A small number of males basically gave us ADME data that you can see listed on this slide. The metabolite analysis is still in process. The Tmax and half-life were confirmed and spot on what we had seen earlier. And I told you that we have now ongoing a study on renal effects. Basically, this looks at more sophisticated parameters to verify whether the elevation that we've seen in 002 in serum creatinine is due to a real effect on renal function, glomerular filtration rate, and or renal plasma, or it's a more benign effect, as is seen for other drugs. And the study is ongoing. We have enrolled 45 subjects so far, and the data are blinded, and looking at the data in a blinded fashion, it seems that there is no reason to be concerned. In fact, they look pretty good, but we, as I said, we have not unblinded the data yet. That should happen in the next few weeks. In fact, talking about the next few weeks, this is a chart of the development as we foresee it for the next future for PA24. You see we're about here right now. The renal effect study shows going all the way until March, but that is for the final report. we are confident that we will be able, about the end of the month or beginning of December, to get unblinded data that will guide the decision on moving on to the next steps. As you can see here, the clinical studies are outlined in purple. We are planning a drug-drug interaction study, an EBA study. We are planning a food effect study to start between the end of the year and early 2007. Other non-clinical studies are down here, and then there will be chemistry manufacturing control study activities and regulatory activities also. And I'll come back to regulatory activities at the end of my presentation. Okay, so that is what I have for PA24, and I would like now to move to the next part of my presentation, which has to do with moxifloxacin. Again, a lot of this is old news to you, but I thought it would be appropriate to summarize it on this slide, reminding you that moxifloxacin indeed is a fluoroquinolone that has shown significant potency against the mycobacterium tuberculosis, that the preclinical data have shown that moxifloxacin-based regimen could shorten the therapy to 3 to 4 months or less. In fact, the data coming from Chennai suggests that it could reduce it to 3 months or less. Those were with alfloxacin. The drug possesses a new mechanism of action for TB, and it has certainly a very good safety record in humans, albeit not for 6 months duration, but it has been used. Actually, this figure is at this point inaccurate. It should be over 55 million users. You know that the product is already sold by Bayer for other indications in many, many countries. So if this unfreezes on me, let's see. Yeah. This, I won't spend much time on this because this is another one of the slides that you've seen a lot, another of the studies by Professor Grosset and his lab that showed the rationale for the study. You see the curve here of the moxie-containing regimen allowing the reaching therapeutic success significantly earlier than the existing regimens. Okay, so that was what guided the TB Alliance to get in contact with Bayer and agree on putting together a global clinical development program for moxifloxacin. And in fact, that led to the signature of an agreement of a contract, actually, in the August of 2005. And the agreement was about conducting a joint program for the clinical development and registration of moxifloxacin for the use in TB patients, and other parties which are all represented here, including the Tuberculosis Trial Consortium, the Center for Disease Control, the Johns Hopkins University, University College of London, the British Medical Research Council, all agreed to be part of this coordinated effort, and certainly the issue of the affordability of the drug has been assessed and addressed. Okay, so I thought that I could show you a list, a table, with the initial studies that of which the clinical development plan is comprised of. And here it is. I picked 4 studies, which are the critical ones, and I will go through them in the next couple of minutes. I thought first to call your attention to the top part of the slide, which shows you 2 studies, study number 27 by TBTC, which was carried out under the supervision direction of Drs. Goldberg, Villarino, and Vernon, where it's a phase 2 study where moxie replaced ethambutol, carried out in North America and Africa, enrolled 336 patients. The study is over, and I'm sure you're all familiar with the results. While the other phase 2 study for moxie replacing ethambutol is completing enrollment as we speak. I think it's not at the last patient, it's very close. Study is it's under responsibility of Dr. Dick Chason of Johns Hopkins University, done in Brazil by the side of Marcus Conde. and as I said, is reaching the target of 170 patients. Moving on to the bottom part of the screen, these are two studies where, well, you see TBTC, study number 28, is a study, another phase two study where moxifloxacin replaces isoniazid, and it's being carried out in the North America, in Africa, in Latin America, and in Europe, and it has a target of 410 patients. Study started enrollment in February of 2006, and we're delighted to see it, the enrollment going literally gangbusters. We are, or they are, almost at 300 patients with good chances of being able to reach a full target before the deadline of 12 months. In fact, the study could be totally enrolled by January of next year. The last study, it's called REMOX-TB, where REMOX stands for Rapid Evaluation of Moxifloxacin in TB. It's carried out by the University College of London, by Professor Stephen Gillespie, and British Medical Research Council, Professor Andrew Nunn. And it has three arms with two comparisons. The first comparison is a phase two study where moxi replaces isoniazid and looks at greater efficacy in sputum conversion at 2 months. And a third, phase three comparison where moxi replaces etambutol versus a standard regimen. And phase three means that this is looking at comparable efficacy in a reduction of relapse rate. Study is being planned. It's almost ready to start. I'm happy to inform the audience that a very critical meeting was held with the FNDA. Was about a week ago, or feels more than that, but it was about a week ago, and was very supportive and very interested in a very, as I said, supportive of the activities here, activities which should lead to trial initiation in early January of 2007. Forgot to mention that TBTC28 also is being carried out by Drs. Goldberg, Villarino, and Vernon, and we hope that the enrollment in REMOX-TB can go as fast as the one in TBTC28. That is a wish. Stay tuned, because that hopefully at the next meetings we'll be able to report about the status of the study. So if those studies work out, and as we all hope and believe, we are looking at completing phase two and phase three clinical evaluation, both for moxifloxacin, so substitute for etambutol, and for isoniazid. An important thing to consider here is that we are looking actually at two regimens, so it's two separate registration programs. And we are hopeful that by that, if of course, if the data is supported, of being ready for filing the different regimens in first quarter of 2010 for the moxi for ethambutol substitution, and in the second quarter of 2011 for the moxi for isoniazid substitution. I thought, and this is the last part of my presentation, I thought that I would take advantage of being here, having your attention, to bring up another point that is very close to our interest. You see here strategic initiatives which are part of our portfolio, but that really focus on they're not strictly drug development programs, but they are supportive of drug development programs. And we think all of these are very important, but I thought I would take a minute of your time to call your attention to our interaction with the importance that we attribute to the interaction and priming, if you wish, of the regulatory authorities in supporting our trials and our activities. And in fact, we hold regulatory forums once a year. And the audience for those forums are the regulators, the developers, all the regulatory agencies, the National Tuberculosis Programs, and all other interested parties and stakeholders from as many countries as possible around the world. And the agenda for these meetings is very intense, a couple of days of discussion panels to basically discuss the key regulatory issues in TB drug development, but which means to educate in a way the authorities into the importance of the issues and to the uniqueness, if you wish, of the TB field. The first meeting was held in 2005 in Washington, D.C., mostly focused to the FDA. And next meeting, and this is why I wanted to mention it now, is planned for December, a little more than a month in London, more focused for Europe and the rest of the world. That's what I had. There's a lot more, in fact, that you can find out about us. If you're interested and you want to jot down our website address, I'm sure that you will find a lot of interesting stuff for you, because I know that you share our passion to accelerate the development of faster treatment for tuberculosis around the world. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Martino. We are running a bit late already, so if anybody has, you know, one very quick, just clarifying question, we'll take it now. Otherwise, I'm going to ask people to hold questions till the question and answer at the end. Andy? You want to get to a microphone? This is being webcast, so I'm going to ask people to use the microphones and to introduce themselves, please.
Andy Vernon, CDC. Just in the interest of full disclosure and credit, although I thank you very much for having mentioned Elsa and myself, I want to be clear that Stefan Goldberg is the project officer for 2728, and Dick Chason, along with Bill Berman, John Johnson at the Uganda site, and several other of our key investigators, have really been critical in moving this work forward. So that means that Dick, in particular, has played a key role in moving MOXIe at multiple levels.
Thank you for that. Thank you, Andy.
Absolutely. Okay, why don't we move on? Is it really quick? Okay.
It was my impression that the REMOX study was primarily funded by the European Commission. I don't see them acknowledge this. Is this no longer the case?
I'm sorry.
It is. I'm sorry. You're right. I think it's on the on one of my slides, but I don't know if it's
it was on the table where all the sponsors are listed. They're certainly not the sole funders at this point. The TB Alliance is significantly funding as well, but absolutely they were the initials and probably still the major funder of that trial. Thank you.
I don't know how to go to the next, but I'm going to leave the problem to somebody else.
While you're introducing, I'll take the floor.
The next presentation is going to be by two speakers, Dr. David McNally and Dr. Andrea Dicon. Dr. David McNally is the director in global clinical development for TibboTech and is the medical leader for TibboTech's new TB compound, TMC-207. Dr. Andrea Dicon is an internal medicine professor at Stellenbosch University in South Africa and collaborated with TibboTech to perform their early bactericidal activity. We are delighted to invite Dr. McNally to give his and Dr. Andrea Dicon to give the presentation on update on TMC-207.
Sorry, we've got a frozen computer here. If we can get some technical help.
I think you have to.
We've tried that. It doesn't escape. No. I tried that too. Though it's a French keyboard, I may be hitting the wrong key. But I'm going to skip through these really fast. Oh, there we go. All right.
Thank you very much, Ann, for this opportunity to present the development program of TMC-207, and I'm very grateful to be sharing this talk with Andreas Dicon, who is one of the co-investigators in our first patient trial, along with Dr. Roxana Rustamji. Is Roxana, did she make it here? Glad you could be here. I will begin by giving a very brief summary of some of the salient past information that's been discovered about this compound for those who have not been able to be at a presentation of data on TMC-207 in the past. And then I will turn over to Andreas to present the results of our proof of concept trial that was done in South Africa last year, and then he'll pass the baton back to me to share with you our future plans. TMC-207 introduced a new class of TB drug with a novel mechanism of action, specifically inhibitor of ATP synthase for mycobacteria. It has had very effective results in both acute and established mouse models of TB infection, and is bactericidal for both drug-susceptible and drug-resistant strains of TB. If you'd like to know more about some of the basic discovery work, I have indicated on the bottom of the slide here a reference to Science, published in January of 2005, and if you can't copy it down, we can give the details to you later. We have concluded to date 6 phase 1 trials, a single ascending dose study going up to 700 milligrams, a multiple ascending dose study going up to 400 milligrams for 14 days, and several drug interaction studies with rifampin, isoniazid, pyrazinamide, and ketoconazole. The key findings in these studies are that the compound has a good linear PK profile. There is a positive food effect, i.e., taking the medicine with food significantly increases the exposure in the volunteer or patient. The compound is metabolized by CYP3A4 cytochrome, and so not surprisingly, there is a significant drug interaction with rifampin, although the contrary is not true. TMC-207 does not affect rifampin levels. It has a long half-life, and steady state is not reached after 2 weeks of administration. In the clinical safety data accumulated so far, with 189 dosed subjects and patients, we haven't observed any serious adverse events related to TMC-207. This 189 includes not only the phase 1 trials, but the clinical patient trial that Andreas is going to discuss. And now I'll ask Andreas to come forward and tell you about that.
Thank you, David, for this opportunity to speak here about this trial. This was the early bactericidal activity, tolerability, and pharmacokinetics study. So the first in-human use of this investigational compound. Just hope I can move this forward somehow. All right, so this was the design of this study. It's a proof of concept study, early bactericidal activity study, where 3 doses of the investigational compound of TMC-207, so 25 milligram, 100, and 400 milligram, were given to patients on 7 consecutive days. And comparator drugs were rifampicin 600 milligram and isoniazid 300 milligram. These are the standard doses that are used in combination treatment. And this regimen was followed in all patients by a 6-month standard South African regulatory 4-drug and 2-drug treatment. Daily sputum counts were taken overnight, and I will show you a bit later how these were analyzed. This is the picture that shows how EBA studies actually work for those of you who are not too familiar with the technique. This is a patient that's been, or let's say sputum counts on agar plates from a patient that has been treated with INH. one collects sputum overnight, and there's a laboratory procedure how one dissolves and prepares that sputum to end up with a solution that can be diluted. And this would be the dilution of 100 times, 1,000 times, 10,000 times, and 100,000 times of that initial sputum without that any drug has been given. And subsequently, one would treat the patient with the first dose of drug, and the next night, one would collect sputum again and do the same procedure and plate it out in the same dilutions over there. And then the next night, next dose, and again, same thing. And in that study, it was done over 7 days. This is now just a two-day EVA. And 3 weeks later, when the colonies have grown, every little dot here represents a colony-forming unit, CFU. One can count them. And on this half, one would probably count something like 45. On this one, 40 perhaps. This one, perhaps 8. And if it's so little, one can move up here and count these. It's probably about 80, should be a factor of 10. And then one can calculate that the difference between this, it would be 40 with that dilution, and that after 2 days gives you a difference. You can divide it by the number of days, and then you have to drop number and CFUs per day and the logarithmic scale. And this is the standard way how one evaluates this. The inclusion criteria for the study I'm reporting here, male or female patients, 18 to 65 years old, treatment naive pulmonary TB, at least one plus smear positive on the Union WHO scale, at least 15 milliliters per sputum overnight were required to be included, and they should not be on or in need of antiretroviral therapy, but patients with HIV were allowed in the study. So these criteria were rather open, so we did not select narrowly any patients for that study. 75 subjects were included, 60% male, age 35 years, range 18 to 61, 31% HIV positive, and the mean baseline sputum count was 6.6 logs, which is about what one would expect in a study like this. This is the main study result from these sputum counts that I've shown you, with all the groups were collected at zero. So they all start off at the same level. The comparator drugs, isoniazid and rifampicin, are these two. And they work very well, and this has been expected like that, and it shows that the laboratory method worked. You must always be aware in a study like this that by the end of a patient that one does not know what's on these plates, it takes 3 weeks to actually count the results. But it turned out that the comparator drugs worked very well, and this is the investigational compound in the lowest dose here, second lowest dose and the highest dose. And the two lowest doses did not show an effect that was significantly different from zero, with the error bars here crossing the zero line. But the 400 milligram dose, as from day four, where the error bar gets below the zero line, shows a consistent effect of further dropping counts. So there is a significant and dose-related but delayed effect of TMC-207 on sputum counts. Pharmacokinetic data is were taken on day seven of the study. It's clear that the 400 milligram dose shows a much higher plasma levels than both other doses, and these were linear pharmacokinetics. And on day seven, the steady state was not reached. So the safety and tolerability data we had, TMC-207 was well tolerated, but during follow-up, two deaths unrelated to TMC-207 occurred. I can tell you that these patients had diseases that were clearly related to tuberculosis in the one case and clearly related to an HIV disease in the other case. So the relation to TMC was really clearly not established. So the conclusions from that study, bactericidal activity of TMC-207 is demonstrated in the 400 milligram group. Steady state levels are not reached within 7 days exposure. Linear PKs in patients that were comparable to volunteer data. There were no safety alerts in that study, and the activity of TMC-207 beyond 7 days needs to be studied further. And if there is not enough time for all the questions to be answered, there will be a poster about this very study today at the given times. It's the poster session number 14, Vaccines, Clinical Trials, and TB Treatment, and both David and me will be there to answer your questions eye to eye if that's required. So I'll hand back over to David to tell you about the future plans of the company with the compound.
Thank you.
Well, given the results from the EBA trial and our assessment that we need to explore TMC-207 beyond 7 days to get a better idea of what its real activity is, we reflected not only on that data but on past data, and we do know from the mouse studies I mentioned earlier that we have, by substituting or adding TMC-207, which we put it in the alphabet soup as J here, in 8 weeks administration to mice, we've actually been able to achieve negative cultures. So that confirms for us the need to go forward. And we also know that TMC-207 is quite effective against both drug-susceptible strains and drug-resistant strains of TB. So in deciding how best to determine long-term efficacy and safety and avoiding what we know is a rifampin interaction with our compound, we have felt that the best group of patients to go forward in the next trial will be patients with drug-resistant TB, where there also is a high unmet medical need and where the benefits from a new compound would hopefully be clearly demonstrated, the potential benefits be clearly demonstrated. So we will be conducting a trial in MDR TB patients newly diagnosed. They will receive standard background therapy, it's BR here on the diagram, but the trial will be randomized, double-blind, and placebo-controlled so that we can give the best opportunity possible to see what TMC-207 can do on its own. We plan a two-stage trial where the first 25% of subjects is 200 total, or patients, 200 total. The first 50, half on placebo and half on TMC-207, will receive 2 months of drug, and with an analysis of those results, we will confirm the dose and dosing schedule that we have determined would be optimal for the next trial. And if that dosing schedule and safety and efficacy merit, we will then go on with the remainder of the trial in an exposure for 6 months. The trial will be monitored by a data safety monitoring board who will make recommend decisions like this, and but the information will remain blinded to those of us who are involved in conducting the trial. After the 2 or 6 month period of study drug, subjects will continue their standard MDR treatment, complete that, and we will have a long follow-up during that period of time to continue to evaluate safety, relapse, various secondary and clinical outcome parameters for efficacy. To summarize, TMC-207 has a new mechanism of action that is efficacious against both drug-susceptible and drug-resistant strains of TB. We've demonstrated activity at a 400 milligram dose from day 4 onwards in our proof-of-concept trial. But dose finding, long-term safety, and efficacy need to be evaluated, and we will plan. We are planning to start this next trial in second quarter of 2007. I'd like, first of all, to thank all of the patients and volunteers who've participated in our trials to date. I would like to thank Dr. Diakon and his team, Dr. Rustamji and her team in South Africa, and especially a hearty thanks to my colleagues in the development program at in TMC 207 in Belgium and in the U.S. who've helped me to conclude this trial.
Again, if there are one or two very short, just clarifying questions for now, and we'll hold further discussion for the end of the session. Okay, if not, thank you. Yeah? No, Bernard.
You presented pool data and two centers. They're very diverse with backgrounds and also especially HIV infection backgrounds. Is this taken into consideration in the analysis? I mean, you presented pooled data, but they from patients were recruited from two diverse centers.
We did look at HIV status and
intercenter variability. Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much, Drs. McNeely and Diakon. Our next speaker, if he's here, is Dr. Christian Lienhardt of the Institut de Recherche pour le Développement in France. Who also spend a significant portion of his time, I believe, these days at the Union, and today is here representing the OFLATUB Consortium and is going to tell us about their studies on gadifloxacin.
Very good. Thank you very much, Anne, for the invitation to present to this extremely booked and packed audience about the advancement of the OFLATUB Consortium for working on the development of gadifloxacin-containing regimen for treatment of TB. This is a joint effort which is being led by a team of 10 institutions coordinated by the Institut de Recherche pour le Développement and funded by European Commission, and jointly working in a partnership with WHO TDR, a team led by Dr. Tom Kanyok. Well, the project started in 2002, and what was the rationale at the time to start thinking about this gadifloxacin-containing regimen for improvement TB treatment? The main point that we started thinking was that despite the treatment of proven efficacy, with 95% shown efficacy with the standard 6 months duration WHO-recommended regimen, TB rates continue to increase, and especially in resource-poor countries. There is a high persistence of default rates, and numerous studies show that these default rates most of the time occur quite late in treatment, mainly after the 4 months. There is a spread of multi-drug resistance, which is even more a problem now with the extensive drug resistance outbreak in South Africa. There is the high impact of HIV infection. Therefore, it's quite obvious that there is a need to improve access to and improve delivery of treatment to TB patients. And there is also maybe one of the ways to increase that, to improve that, is to decrease the duration of treatment, either with new drugs or with new combinations of drugs. And this is with this in mind that we've looked at what was being done by multiple scientists in the world, and there has been some work done on ofloxacin, which proven with bactericidal activity against M. tuberculosis has been proven by studies published in the early and mid-90s. This drug, which is rapidly absorbed and have a high concentration in respiratory and secretion macrophage in the lungs. It is a low-cost drug, including WHO essential drug list, and what is interesting, has been tried in various trials. The most important one, and I'm very pleased that Dr. Nayanan is here chairing the session. The most important is the trial led by the Trial Research Center in Chennai, which has been published in the Indian Journal of Tuberculosis in 2002. And within this trial, various regimens, which are just laid out here, have been tried, including ofloxacin to various combination of treatment with various duration, 3 months, 4, 5, or 4 months. And the interesting aspect of this series of patients which were put under this virus treatment is that the percentage of smear conversion after 2 months, whatever the regimen, were between 92 and 98%. Interestingly also, looking at the relapse after 6 months of treatment, if I remember well, the rate of relapse was between 2%, which was extremely good efficacy, and 13%, which is, of course, less than acceptable efficacy. So on this basis of this treatment trial being done in Chennai, we started to think about what would be the next step. Chennai has open avenue, has open really new concept of being able to change one of the components of the classical regimen. But maybe what was needed is to go on a randomized control trial because these series were not tested against a control regimen. So we started to look and we found that there were a series of quinolone which could be included in the combination, you know, with the hope of shortening treatment. And there were ofloxacin, of course, but more recently, gatifloxacin and moxifloxacin, which are two new methoxyfluoroquinolone, and which show a very good activity against Mycobacterium tuberculosis in vivo and in vitro. The advantage of gatifloxacin, and that's what we considered that drug, was that it is a cheap drug, and that it was presently being done on generic production in India. And therefore, if we were able to show that we could indeed reduce treatment to 4 months duration, and therefore improve, avoid the problem of defaulting, and therefore improve cure rate, it would be even better to do it with a very cheap treatment and being done in South for South patients under generic production. Gatifloxacin is free of many of the class effects of quinolone, especially phototoxicity. It has a potential cardiotoxicity with a QT enlargement, which is a class effect. And it was reported to have, and that drug was reported to have a bit more than other ones, early effect on glucose homeostasis with potential severe hypo and hyperglycemia. So we started to think how, and with the help of TDR, which was interested in having a development for shortened TB treatment, and we were more academic persons willing to do a randomized control trial to assess the efficacy of this combination, including gatifloxacin. We worked to a development plan which included several aspects, phase 1 toxicology and pharmacokinetic studies, a phase 2 trial, and a phase 3 randomized control trial. I'm going to skip about the phase 1 and PK toxicology and PK studies. If there are any questions, I think that we can answer that thereafter. The phase 2 trial has been carried out last year, and early results were shown to you in, the same room by Professor Mitchinson and Roxana Rustomji and Tulin Tilani from South Africa. This phase 2 trial was a serial sputum colony count study, which was intending to assess the sterilizing activity of gatifloxacin-containing regimen, but in comparison with other fluoroquinolone regimens over the 2 months intensive treatment phase. It was designed as an open-label phase 2 randomized trials, and the aims were to compare three fluoroquinolone which were substituted for ethambutol. What were the different arms? We had the control arms, which was the classical 2 months isoniazid-rifampicin pyrazinamide ethambutol. And then the three various arms were testing the three following quinolone, ofloxacin, moxifloxacin, and gatifloxacin. After 8 weeks, all patients were shifted to the standard rifampicin isoniazid practice. How did we proceed with the study? There was a screening at first with 412 persons being screened and then 226 willing to collaborate. And as you can see, after randomization, we had quite an even repartition of patients according to the various arms. What we did is over the first 2 months of treatment, where we really wanted to assess the sterilization activities, we carried out a series of sputum colony counts on series of sputum being detected at the following time, 0, 2, 7, 14, etc. The culture were done on 7H11 media. What about now analysis of the data? If we group all arms together here, what we can see is that if we put in a y-axis the log CFU count that we obtain per minute sputum over time, we can see that there is a decrease and that this decrease follows an exponential decrease over time with all the sputum culture decreasing to a level of reaching almost the limit of detection. we tried several type of analysis, and in order to try to represent the best we could this pattern here. And we found out using the nonlinear modeling regression models that we could represent the best the effect of sterilization of the virus drugs using this model showing the bi-exponential aspect with a very steep decrease of the last first week, 0 to 7 days, and then a more low decline in CFU counts over time. The first raw results we obtained are shown here, and we can see that over time we had a decline in CFU counts, which were about similar for all the drugs during the steep first phase of the 0 to 7 days, and then with the differentiation which was increasing over time between, on one side, the control regimen and the ofloxacin containing regimen, and then the moxifloxacin and the gatifloxacin regimen. So we could see, especially at the low phase, at the slow phase, sorry, a difference between the control and ofloxacin on one side and moxifloxacin and gatifloxacin on the other side. We restarted this analysis again and then decided to adjust on various factors such as age, sex, HIV, and chest X-ray extent of disease, mainly because going back to the data, we found that there was an uneven distribution of HIV and chest X-ray extent of disease despite randomizations among the virus group. And when we carried out this new modeling analysis, trying to show again the bi-exponential aspect, we found out that there was a preferred superposition of effect between the control and the ofloxacin regimen and a preferred superposition of effect between the gatifloxacin and the moxifloxacin arms. So what conclusion could we draw from these experiments is that when substituted for ethambutol, both moxi and gati kill significantly faster and at equal rates in the early and late phase than control. Ofloxacin substitution had no significant effect. The observed increase in late phase killing with this regimen support a probable reduction of the duration of therapy of at least 1 month. And SCC modeling could be the basis, and this is a little bit going more out of the scope of this present presentation, but I think something extremely interesting for the future is the use of SCC as a system to have an early marker of treatment efficacy if we want to evaluate new regimens of treatment of tuberculosis. So then we carried out with a phase 3 trial, a phase 3 randomized control trial, where we decided to test a 4-month gatifloxacin-containing regimen with a standard 6-month regimen recommended by WHO. The method is an open-label randomized control trial, and we are intending to look at the non-inferiority of the regimens. The treatments are, the test one is 2 months gatifloxacin, isoniazid, rifampicin, pyrazinamide, followed by 2 months of gatifloxacin, isoniazid, and rifampicin. The control is a classic WHO recommended 6 months regimen. The sample size is 1,035 patients per arm, which have to be followed up for 2 years after completion of treatment in order to assess rates of relapse. Randomization were done per center. It's a multi-center trial, and we'll show you where the sites are. So the study is taking place in 5 sites in Africa, in Senegal, in Guinea, in Benin, in Kenya, and in South Africa. The recruitment of patients is about similar in 5 sites, 400 patients per site. We want to recruit, and we have started recruiting patients 1 year and a half ago, age 18 to 65 years, people who were diagnosed recently with pulmonary tuberculosis. There was a list of a long list of exclusion criteria, which you can see here, with history of TB within the recent years, concomitant infection including HIV, especially at WHO stage 3 and 4. Due to the dysglycemia problem of gatifloxacin, we decided that we are not going to include any patient with either history or family history of diabetes, and we decided to do a fasting glycemia and exclude those who were more than the value of 1.26 or 6.93 minimal per liter. Then other exclusion criteria, which are shown here. Initial examination, there was a pre-screening. We wanted to assess whether there is a potentiality of multidrug resistant at start, so all patients were tested with the MSHIT in order to exclude them from the trial at start. The complete clinical examination was done, and then we carried out a series of tests, chest X-ray, blood collection, looking at fasting glycemia, full blood count, etc., ECG, urinary pregnancy test. And once people had signed informed consent, then they were put under treatment following the randomization. The initial phase of treatment for 2 months was done on a daily observation, daily dot, either in hospital, in health centers, or at home, but if it were at home, then in this situation it was under the supervision by a supporter who was trained at the beginning of the trial. The continuation phase treatment was given on a weekly basis, and again with an agreement with a DOT supporter being identified that the doses should be observed. There is a regular monthly follow-up, and the intention is to assess observance of treatment, of course, the clinical aspects, microbiology tests repeated every month, and of course, occurrence of adverse events. Follow-up after treatment, people are seen regularly, as you can see here, with regular clinical examination and sputum collected for smear and culture, and in case of positive culture, the possibility to do a drug sensitivity testing. What are the endpoints of the trial? So there are two aspects, the efficacy and the safety one. The efficacy aspects, first, the primary outcome is the percent relapse at 24 months. And this will be followed by a secondary outcome, which is looking at time to relapse, defined from the date of treatment cure, end of treatment, either 4 months or 6 months, up to the date of relapse. We also wanted to look at the percent culture conversion at 8 weeks and the percent of patients cured in each arm by the end of treatment. And finally, looking at time to a composite composed of failure relapse endpoint and see, grouping all together, whether there is a difference between the various arms. Safety, the first primary outcome is the percent adverse events in each arm, and the secondary is the distribution and type and grade of these various adverse events. Status of recruitment, I say that we started 1.5 years ago. In fact, we started in June 2005. We have had some problems related to delivery of drug or some other problems related to getting ethical approval and so. I will come back on that later. But the status of recruitment is as follows. We have recruited about half of the patients, 950 about. Problems. We have faced problems, and I think it's important that we do speak openly about the problems that we have faced. And the problems are related with gatifloxacin, because although at the start of the trial we were informed, looking at the brochure, that gatifloxacin was responsible of this glycemia effect, there has been in January of this year a paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine by Park Whealy, which reported an increased risk of hypoglycemia with gatifloxacin as compared to other fluoroquinolone. And that was a case-control study carried out in several hospitals, looking at patients who had been hospitalized for hypo or hyperglycemia, and then going back and see the type of quinolone they were being treated. And obviously, having been treated with gatifloxacin increased the risk of hypoglycemia compared to other drugs. However, the overall rate of dysglycemia, hypo and hyperglycemia, as reported in this study, was about 1.10%. Interestingly, the age of the patients was about 78, so it's a study which was run in Northern America. And the main problem of gatifloxacin were related to the presence of a diabetes. Following this, we have been informed of a change of the drug label by BMS. BMS is the company which is commercializing gatifloxacin in the United States of America under the name Teqrin, which is not the pharmaceutical company with whom we are dealing. But we've been informed that they changed the label following the publication probably of this New England Journal of Medicine paper. And there is, although it was a warning that the drug could create hypo or hyperglycemia, then there's been a change in label stating very firmly that diabetes was a contraindication for prescription of gatifloxacin. And lastly, we heard in April 2006 that BMS decided to return the license of gatifloxacin to Kyorin, which is the inventor of the drug. It was not a withdrawal from the market, it was a return for commercial reasons of the license to Kyorin. So we were informed about this, and then we thought, okay, what should we do in our trial where we are really presently assessing the use of these drugs to shorten TB treatment. With the recent aspect, with this recent development, should we consider continuing? Is there scope, is there a goal for gatifloxacin continuing regimen for treatment of TB? So we decided, and that has been done in a very, very strong and close collaboration with the Study Data Monitoring Committee. And we first decided we should and we have to strengthen our exclusion criteria and glycemia monitoring within the trial. And this is what we did, making very sure that there is a narrow window of values for fasting glycemia at the start, and whoever falls outside the values will not be recruited into the trial. And then we enhanced glycemia monitoring. We did enhance it, and how, especially during the first 2 months, with repeated fasting glycemia at start, and then 8 days, 15 days, 28, 56 days, and then every month, plus a non-fasting glycemia taken 4 hours after the first dose, which is the time where there has been reported that hypoglycemia could occur. And then what we have then decided as well is to increase and strengthen the questions being addressed to the patients in terms of presence of signs and symptoms of hypo or hyperglycemia and family history of diabetes. As I say, all these modifications were discussed with and agreed by the Trial Data Monitoring Committee, and all amendments of the protocol were submitted to ad hoc institutional review boards or institutional ethics committee. Recently, the MCC audited the MCC is a regulatory agency in South Africa, and they did audit the South African site. And they, after that, they reviewed information concerning it was going according to GCP requirements and recommended trial continuation. So this is the situation as we are now experiencing it. As I said, it's an effort which involves a large amount of persons located in north and in south part of the world. And I would like to thank all the persons who are helping us and helping me in coordinating this large trial in Africa and in Europe. I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Christian. Are there any short questions for Dr. Leinhardt at this time? If you could go to a microphone, please.
Okay, I'm Baba Kamaldin from Medusa Campus in West of Limpopo, South Africa. Thanks for your presentation. I just wanted to know, I think you mentioned something about excluding the MDR TB cases using midges. I wanted to know because it will take you some time before you have the culture and then before you can do the susceptibility testing. So how do you make sure that you start the patient on the right treatment or the test or the investigative arm of the treatment, considering the time lag before you get your result of
Yes, no, you're very right. So what we do, in fact, we have a two steps screening process. And at the first visit, we do an MGIT test. And MGIT, we get a result between 10 to 15 days, 16 days at the most. And then we wait for this result. And then we have the result. The MGIT tells us only whether it is rifampicin resistant or not. But on the basis of having a rifampicin resistant, we take that as an assumption of a potential MDR-TB. And then we don't include these patients.
Okay, but my second question now is we have to wait for 10 days now. So do you start a patient on treatment immediately or you wait for that?
We wait for that time.
Are they randomized?
Sorry?
Est-ce qu'ils sont randomisés au début ou après le
18? Ils sont randomisés au début. En fait, oui, c'est ça, ils sont randomisés au début, oui.
Christian, could you translate that for the rest of the audience?
Andrew is always speaking French to me, so I'm lost. His French is much better than my English, that's why. The question was whether patients were randomized at the time of initial screening or later, and it is at the time of initial screening.
Thank you. Let's move on to the next speaker. Thank you, Christian. Our next speaker is Dr. Makoto Matsumoto. He's director of the Microbiological Research Institute of the Otsuka Pharmaceutical Company from Japan. And Dr. Matsumoto is going to present an update on Otsuka's clinical compound OPC-67683.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ginsberg and Dr. Ryan. And also, thank you very much for the TB Alliance for giving me an opportunity to present here today. So last year, so I presented our compound in this conference, and I used this slide. And when we initiated a program for searching a new anti-tuberculosis agent, we focused on these four issues. And especially, try to find out a new compound which has activity against the inhibitory activity against microlic acid biosynthesis, because microlic acid is a well-known and also the very important component in microbacteria. So we focus on searching the inhibitor of microlic acid biosynthesis. We found several new chemical structures, and we selected one molecule, which was a derivative of imidazoxazoles here. And these derivatives is a Nobel-class microbacteria-specific anti-tuberculosis agent with inhibiting microlic acid synthesis and also free from mutagenicity. And then we concluded these compound series would be Nobel-class anti-tuberculosis agent effective against M. tuberculosis, including MDR-TB. And finally, we succeeded to find out OPC-6063. This is the structure of this compound. And you can see the backside of the compound. So that building is our Microbiological Research Institute. And this compound was discovered in that building. And so first of all, I would like to show you some brief summary I was presented last year in this conference. So OPC has potent microbacteria-specific activity in vitro with an MIC range between 0.006 to 0.024 microgram per ml, and shows no cross-resistance with any of currently used tuberculosis drug. The mechanism of action for OPC's potential anti-tuberculosis activity is thought to be due to an inhibitory activity against the synthesis of microlic acids in microbacteria. OPC's presumed mechanism of action provides an explanation for the compound possesses microbacteria-specific anti-tuberculosis activity and does not show any activity against gram-positive and gram-negative bacteria or intestinal bacterial flora. OPC has highly and dose-dependently active against intracellular M. tuberculosis H37RV after a 4-hour pulse exposure, and this activity at a concentration of 0.1 microgram per ml was similar to that of rifampicin at a concentration of 3 microgram per ml. And the OPC has showed a greater potency in the animal model of tuberculosis than did the first-line tuberculosis drugs, rifampicin and isoniazid. OPC demonstrated a therapeutic efficacy at a dose of 0.625 milligram per kilogram, considered to be equivalent to that of rifampicin. We think that this dose is the minimum dose the compound can demonstrate the efficacy in the model. And the efficacy plasma and lung level of OPC at a dose of 0.625 milligram per kilogram were 100 nanogram and about 300 nanogram per ml respectively. So these concentrations that we would like to achieve in the humans, this is a minimum effective dose, minimum effective concentrations. And no antagonistic activity of OPC in combination with currently used drugs was observed in either in vitro or in vivo. The combination of OPC with rifampicin and PDA inhibited a remarkably quick eradication by at least 2 months of viable TB bacilli in the lung, in comparison with the standard regimen consisting of rifampicin, isoniazid, ethambutol, and pyrazinamide. So today, I'd like to focus on the two topics. One is the mode of action, the other one is the activity against the dormant organisms. First, I'd like to present the mode of actions, not the mode of the dance. And so, as you know well, so mycobacteria, so tuberculosis, possesses three subclass mycorrhizae, mycorrhizic acid. So, and we can identify using a thin chromatography, thin layer chromatography. And here you can see alpha mycorrhizic acid and methoxy mycorrhizic acid and keto mycorrhizic acid. And so both OPC and isoniazid inhibit dose dependently, but there are some differences of the mode of the actions between the two compounds. So as you can see, so OPC can inhibit only methoxy mycorrhizic acid and keto mycorrhizic acid in the dose dependently, but not on the alpha mycorrhizic acid. But isoniazid can inhibit the all of the subclass mycorrhizic acid. And furthermore, when the subclass mycorrhizic acid was inhibited by OPC, so additional band was appeared. That is, hydroxy mycorrhizic acid is an intermediate. And so this table shows 50% inhibitory concentration of OPC and isoniazid. And as you can see here, so our compound inhibits about 20 to 30 times more potent than the isoniazid. This concentration is well correlated to the MIC levels. And so these results indicate that so target of a compound maybe is one of these methoxy transferase, and the other one is maybe unknown oxidase. So when we treated OPC to the bacilli, so keto and the methoxy mycorrhizic acid decrease. And on contrast, intermediate hydroxy mycorrhizic acid increase. So that's why so there, these two enzymes is maybe the target of the compound. But this is a non-oxidase, so now we are making effort to find out these enzymes. The strategy for identifying a target enzyme is very simple. We are trying to isolate the resistant organism in the laboratory and identify the differences between sensitive and resistant strains. So we isolated OPC resistant strain derived from the BCG Tokyo strains in our laboratory. And we mixed these strains with OPC, carbon 14 labeled OPC compound, and analysis using HPLC method. And when we mix with sensitive strain, so most of the radioactivities appear in one main metabolite, and so decrease you know, mother molecules. On contrast, when we add OPC with incubated with resistant bacteria, so none of the metabolites appeared. And we analyzed this main metabolite using LC mass mass, and we estimated the structure and synthesize that estimated structures and analysis using LC mass-mass again. And we confirmed the structure is one we estimated the structure. Here we can, confirm it. And another finding is showing in these tables. So when we mix with a sensitive strain with OPC, and extracted with two volume of acetonitrile, and almost 80% of the radioactivity was recovered, but 20% of the radioactivity still in a pellet. But on contrast, so when we use resistant bacteria, so all of the radioactivity is recovered. So it suggests that you know, some of the metabolite or some of the molecules bind to the bacilli, maybe target enzymes in the covalently bind to the target enzymes. So now we hypothesize the mode of actions like this. So maybe it's quite similar to the mode of action of the PA24. And first reported is in 2000 by Dr. Stober group. And in that paper, so they said that they have also demonstrated resistant bacteria in the laboratory and identified some mutation in FGD, which is the enzyme catalyzed glucose to gluconolactone. And so in our study, so our compound did not any mutation in this FGD enzyme. So maybe a little bit different between our compound and PA24. So this enzyme need F420 as the cofactors. These cofactors is synthesized by GTP by these enzymes. So if the mutation is occurred in these enzymes, our compound OPC and PA24 shows resistance. And so most of the, we also believe that you know some other enzyme catalyzes the OPC in inactive form to the active form. And last year, Dr. NIH group discovered one enzyme, RV3547. That enzyme catalyzes, converts inactive form to the active form. And in our study, so we also identified the mutation in the resistance strain in these enzymes. And also, I presented in the last slide, we have already identified, you know, one metabolite molecules by tuberculosis. And that is a death nitro or imidazoxazole with the same substituent. But so this molecule does not show any activity against tuberculosis. So now I'm thinking that the intermediate from here to here, maybe some of the radical compound attack to the target protein and bind the covalently and inhibit kill the bacteria, we imagine. Now we are searching this target protein right now. And next, I'd like to show the activity against dormant organisms. So why eradication of TB is time-consuming and why relapse occurs? And most people, most researchers and most doctors believe the reason why is existing the dormant strains. So these are figures I took from the Dr. Michinson's slide, a paper. And so there are many types of population in the lung. And so for the speed of the metabolism and growth in a high, so isoniazid kills the dividing bacteria. But the rifampicin may be believed to kill the bacteria with part of metabolism. And so PDA maybe can kill the dormant organisms in acid environment. And as you know, so pyrazinamide is play a role, a very important role for shortening the treatment duration. So most people believe that killing the dormant strain is very important for the therapy of the tuberculosis. And so in aerobic conditions, tuberculosis can grow so quickly. And in these conditions, isoniazid show the most potent anti-tuberculosis activities. So isoniazid demonstrate the dose-dependently and more quickly killing activities. On contrast, metronidazole does not work in these conditions. And of course, our compound showed the activity in these conditions as well. But next we would like to we try to test the activity of OPC against dormant strain. So there are many models reported in to make the dormant. But so maybe one of the popular model is a WHERE model. But this model is very simple method, but very, you know, difficult to reproduce. So we tried again, and we modified the procedure of the WHERE model. So we first set up the quite similar to the WHERE model reported by the paper by WHERE. And next we moved to the anaerobic culture box. And so doing the 6 days incubation. And after that, we added the test compound and following 6 days incubation. And we counted the number of the bacilli in the plate. And this is a result of the against the dormant strains. So in this model, so isoniazid does not work, even if in a high concentration of the 10 microgram per ml. On contrast, so metronidazole can work in these conditions. And our compound also work in these conditions, even if it's a low concentration of OPC. So now, so we are moving to the clinical trials and the current status of the clinical development I'd like to show in the last slide. So first one studies, single dose study in the UK and in Japan completed. And the multiple dose study in the UK are also completed. And the phase two study in South Africa, it's called a small EBS study, also completed. Now we move to the next step, and a large EBS study now ongoing. Yeah. Thank you very much. Ah, sorry. These are the members involving our research project. Yeah, thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Matsumoto. Are there any short questions for Dr. Matsumoto? Andy, would you go to a microphone, please, and introduce yourself? Not that we don't all know you. But.
Andy Vernon, CDC again. I just wondered where the work in South Africa was being conducted. I didn't see it on the slide. I wondered where the work in South Africa was being conducted. I did not see it on the slide.
Oh, where in the South Africa, you mean? In the Cape Town, the Stellenbosch University.
Thank you.
All right.
The next presentation. The next presentation is an interesting one. It's an interesting background. Dr. David Edwards is a biomedical engineer. He's from Harvard and has specialization in the field of fluid mechanics, interfacial transport phenomenon, drug delivery, and aerosol. What has he got to do with TB? Let's listen to him.
Well, what an introduction. Thank you very much. I'm really delighted to be here. You may not really know, but actually I'd like to talk about a new mode. Actually, it's obviously not a new mode of delivery, but a mode that we think we've validated for delivery of TB drugs, and also specifically about an opportunity for MDR-TB that we believe is ready for the clinic. Background as far as inhaled drugs is concerned, which is sort of the area that I've worked in for the last 15 years and from which I've entered this community. We began inhaling in the sort of modern era drugs for asthma in the early 1960s after having treated asthma and COPD in general by oral agents. And it was realized that if we could deliver the drugs to the lungs, we could reduce the dose in order of magnitude or two. And we developed at that time pretty much perfume valve technology for delivery. And actually, that's mostly the technology that's still being used. And we would not have the new technology were it not for the protein, the DNA, the recombinant DNA revolution, the protein revolution of the early 1970s, which led to what we thought would be a revolution in therapeutic care. There were estimates of 25 to 50% of all new drugs being protein-based. And that didn't happen for various reasons. One of them was that we realized that we needed to deliver these agents by injection. And so there was 20 years of work to find better ways to deliver proteins than by injection. And it was pretty much figured out by the late 80s that if we could deliver drugs, proteins, more efficiently than with perfume valve technology, we could avoid injections. And so that led to work in the 1990s, and I did work also at that time, and led to a new way of designing aerosols that would allow us to deliver a lot more efficiently to the lungs, and is the basis of some clinical programs that are going on right now. And we've done more work more recently. At the same time, what's happened and has not really been catching the attention of the pharmaceutical industry, which has been driving that other technology development, there are a few problems, one of which we're talking about now, which is a focus of work that I'm doing today. So interestingly, from a point of view of somebody like myself, who's approaching this problem from an aerosol science point of view, we've got this amazing problem of airborne infectious disease. We have ways of solving it, but we're not doing it. And the question is why, and there's a few reasons. One, the pills and needle approach in cases, for example, for TB, there's issues that everybody's talking about here today to reduce the time of therapy is an issue for where these therapies are being delivered and the practicalities involved. If you look at aerosolizing, people have thought, obviously, about aerosolizing antibiotics before for TB and have done it. But the technology that has been available until now, sort of the old technology, involves nebulization. And given the doses required, it really requires like 15 or 20 minutes of nebulization, which the nebulizer is not that practical, and the time is not that practical. The convenient inhalers are not efficient enough, and the market forces, at least until recently, perhaps still are not there. And so there's a threefold problem which sort of escapes academia, sort of escapes industry, and it's perfect for us. So the issue here just is that there are many reasons to commend delivery to the lung, depending on what we're delivering. It's non-invasive. You've got a surface area the size of the tennis court. It's very, obviously, highly capillarized. It's sort of a better environment for macromolecules and biological material, and we're also doing work. There's a lot of interest now in mucosal and systemic immunity, both possible via the lungs. We're doing a few things in this area. One, we developed a technology in 1987 based upon redesigning particles that I'm going to talk about, and applied it to TB for the first time in 2003. And we're also working on a kind of particle for aerosol delivery where you form these kinds of particles of nanoparticles, you self-assemble them and deliver them to the lungs. We're especially looking at this as a vector for delivery of antigens for TB and other infectious diseases. There's work that my student Ling Wang will present tomorrow on looking at things like BCG and special ways of drying and delivering those also by aerosol. And there's also some work that is part of a company that we've started looking at reducing the spread of airborne infectious disease. But what I'd like to talk about today is particularly this technology and its relevance to delivery of antibiotics, particularly for MDR-TB. So just as a two-minute background on why you would redesign particles to look like this. And so this is standard kind of aerosol particle, around 3 microns in size, 1 to 5 microns in size, the particle size you normally would make drugs of if you're delivering them by aerosol. If they're smaller, you expire them, and if they're bigger, they fall out in the head, typically. And so what we did was to say that there's a problem with that. It's hard to make those things. They stick together when you make them, moreover, if they're dry. And so if you made them big, they would stick together a lot less. And if you made them light, they would get into the lungs. And so that was the concept. And so you can make the argument, which I'm not going to drag you through. But the bottom line, if you took a gram of powder of 12-micron-sized particles or 3-micron-sized particles, these would be about 256 times easier to disperse. And the advantage then shows up in, number one, you can deliver a lot more. And so you in the Eli Lilly program in phase three, they have delivered per dose on the order of 90 milligrams of growth hormone by aerosol in a couple puffs. And so that's a lot more drug than you would normally. That's kind of a nebulization dose and the kind of dose we're needing for TB and antibiotic delivery. It's efficient. This is a scintigraphy study where we coated the particles with technetium and looked at where they went, and so it's an efficient way of delivery. And finally, you can use a simple inhaler. So the inhaler we're hoping to use in humans soon is this, and it's the one there on the bottom, and it's actually, some of you may know it, it's a generic inhaler that's still used for delivery of asthma drugs. So what I'd like to focus on here is the TB application, and this is just some data for those of you who haven't been following the inhaled protein story, and it's relevant here, and so I'm going to just pause a second on it. When we talk about delivering drugs like antibiotics to the lung, it's not only delivering to the lung, it's also delivery to the systemic circulation, and that'll be an important part of the story. If you look at growth hormone here, injected 12 human volunteers, and inhaled, you see a very similar profile. It's around 8, I think, or 9% bioavailability for that 22 kilodalton protein. But the point is that you have also systemic exposure via the lungs. You know the problem, and so I'm not going to belabor that. Why would you inhale? So there's many reasons to inhale drugs or think about inhaling drugs, and many of these come actually from similar logic for other kinds of things like asthma. Number one, when you deliver the drugs, if you think about it, I'm delivering to the, you know, the lung is a major organ of infection, and by delivery orally, I lose some, and then there's a systemic circulation, and I have some lung absorption. By delivery to the lungs, I immediately have a lot higher concentration relative to the same body dose via anything else, whether it's injection or oral. And so it's a way of increasing local lung concentration at a given body dose. There's a possibility and data out there indicating that there's a possibility, obviously, of reducing transmission more rapidly. And then there's some other advantages, including injection or potential advantages. And then there's also the vaccine problem. So what we've been thinking about and talking about for a few years is, wouldn't it be interesting to think about an inhaled therapy? And what I'm going to talk about right now is something more near term. And the concept we began with, among other drugs, capremycin. The idea that it's injected right now for MDR-TB in some countries. So we know its safety profile. One of the advantages of the inhaled route is the possibility of taking something that has a known safety profile, going a different route, and possibly improving efficacy. But in addition, in this case, eliminating an injection. And so the concept was, could you actually develop an MDR-TB therapy where you would replace whatever the injected antibiotic is by an inhaled capremycin, so you'd have the oral therapy with an inhaled capreomycin. This has been funded by the NIAID, and it's a collaboration with Tony Hickey's group, and Chuck Pelequin's also been involved in this as well. And so the work, we've now gone through PK/PD and two-week toxicology studies, and I'd like to review that. The word about capremycin, for those of you who need a refresher on that, it's very active against TB, but it's been not used widely for reasons that relate to cost, among other things, until now. Results by the Heifetz et al. Group, or the group involved in Heifetz, showed that it could be very active against non-replicating TB in vitro. Lilly transferred the manufacturing know-how. It is a Lilly compound. It's off patent now to the developing world, and so there's an opportunity for lower cost, which is good. And then the point that I keep alluding to, there is quite a bit of human data actually showing that there's a
it's promising to inhale drugs if you could do it conveniently. So we are not going to drag you through this sort of engineering picture, but just to show that there is a there's actually a facility where you make these things, and so you put the drug and you spray it, and you spray it in such a way that you get these things to come out and look like these hollow spheres here that I can't really point that out. But anyway, the those little things down on the far left, these particles tend to be like crumpled pieces of paper, and so we can we have this aerosol property, and that's more specifically what the capromycin particles look like. So this is mostly capromycin. It's 80% drug, so mostly what you're seeing is drug. These things are hollow, and they fly well. So I'm going to now just. So we did the study at UNC in the lab of Tony Hickey. So Tony's lab did the study. And this was firstly PK and guinea pigs delivering by aerosol. So acute dose. And I show here, I don't know how to make this thing point. I show here, so here's the low dose, intermediate dose, high dose. It's a dose escalation versus IM and IV. And I want to point out a few things. Number one, the high dose is not very high. It's over or under, let's see, it's an order of magnitude lower than the injected dose. And why did we choose that low dose? We chose it because we wanted to be able to deliver the drug in a couple puffs. So the, we just sort of chose that level. But we'll come back to this PK profile here in a second. We then did a PD study where we infected animals by aerosol, and then 4 weeks after infection began treatment, daily treatment, whether it was so untreated group, there's an IM group, daily delivery of capromycin, the placebo, 1 mg, 5 mg, 10 mg, and that corresponds here to 1.2 mg per kg. So it's as I say, over a order of magnitude lower than the injected dose. So the lung, so it's a relatively small reduction in CFUs. So we're trying to publish a paper, which is why I hid that scale there. But this is CFUs, and we have a similar reduction by inhalation as injection, and the spleen shows not a significant reduction. What I'd like to do is come back. How do you go backwards? Oops. If I go back here and look at the systemic absorption, so I didn't point out the fact that you have, I think it's around 60% absolute bioavailability. So the capromycin that you put in the lungs is mostly absorbed, ultimately. But you're putting in a very small amount in the body. And so at least at this dose, your systemic levels are low. And so not very surprisingly, I'm going the wrong way, not very surprisingly, the spleen is not showing a significant reduction. We would like to follow this up with higher doses. Having said that, clearly the intention is a capromycin inhalation and coupled with oral second-line drugs, which is the goal. The good news, as far as we're concerned, is the possibility of a simple, really low-cost, couple-puff way of delivering your injectable. For MDR-TB, in the hope that would work out, we went ahead with the NIAID funding and made material for a tox study. We've completed the CRO study at Charles River, 2-week rat and dog inhalation study, and which was successful. And the technology now has been licensed to Medicine in Need, which is an NGO focused on drug delivery. In Cambridge and in South Africa, and Bernard Furry, who probably has questions for me too, is going to lead this into the clinic with Ed Nardell, who's at the medical school. So that's the story, and I'd just like to thank the funders. There's also funding from the Gates Foundation on our vaccine work, and some subset of my group and my other colleagues. Thank you very much.
Any quick questions for Dr. Edwards before we open the floor to questions for all the speakers?
I'm just lining up for questions to all the speakers.
Oh, okay. All right, then. Thank you, Dr. Edwards. Why don't we go ahead and start the general discussion session? Mark, you've got the microphone.
Hi, yeah, this is an exciting session. It's exciting to see EBA data, and at least from one of the companies. We would love to see it from both. The point I'm going to make is also a shameless pitch for anybody who's going to be still here tomorrow to come to the late breaker session where we're going to be presenting the results of our TB R&D mapping. But basically, we found out that there is $400 million a year available for all phases of TB R&D from the top 40 donors, and that only last year, only $120 million was spent on new drug development for TB, of all new drugs, basic and clinical. And so our hypothesis is that the field really isn't going to be healthy unless it receives a fivefold increase in funding to $600 million a year for drugs and $2 billion a year for TB R&D overall. And just by means of comparison, NIH alone spends over $700 million per year on HIV drug development. And as you also know, many, many drug companies are spending hundreds of millions or billions of dollars on drugs. And so our field really needs to grow in an exponential way to achieve those levels. And if any of you can't make it tomorrow, I've actually brought copies of our TB and R&D report, and I'm just going to pass them out until they run out.
Thank you, Mark. Why don't we alternate microphones here? Kevin?
Okay. Kevin Fenley from New Jersey. Thanks for the exciting session, and actually a special thanks to David Edwards on behalf of our patients with painful butts that we give them from injection sites, so it's very exciting. I had a question primarily related to 207, but I guess it pertains to some of the other new drugs, and that is, of course, many of our patients are HIV-infected and get extra pulmonary TB, and I was concerned about the interaction with rifampicin, and if that has implications for interactions with, obviously, the ARVs as well as corticosteroids, since we're now sort of feeling more comfortable using corticosteroids for treating TB meningitis. I was wondering if anybody could comment on that.
David, did you want to respond to that? Well, why don't you come up to the microphone and...
Sure, sorry. So the question is on 207, given the interaction you showed with rifampicin, does that have implications for interactions with the ARVs and or corticosteroids, the latter of which we're using now, you know, to treat TB meningitis?
We have not yet performed specific ARV drug interaction studies, but we have reason to think that that may be an issue. And which is why we will have in the next trial, we will admit HIV-positive patients, but not people who are on need immediately of starting antiretroviral therapy. We do have questions to learn about.
Okay. And how about corticosteroids?
We don't have a specific exclusion for that, although we will not be... enrolling patients that have extra pulmonary disease in this for this trial. We have basic efficacy data to collect, which is hard to do.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Yes, George Amufa from Ghana, Minister of Health. I thank you for the exciting presentations, and in fact, I had a sight here listening to the new drug developments and other things. It's quite exciting, but there's a lingering concern which I have, and it's not the fault of probably anybody. And the concern is that there appears to be a cycle of drug resistance to the drug, the development of new drugs, resistance to the new drugs that have been developed, and then the cycle goes on and on. And my lingering concern is whether one way or the other we are not contributing to that cycle by the desire to release some of these drugs too quickly, I mean, onto the market. I mean, and I think it goes to the regulatory, I mean, authorities. You see, if we are not careful and we are not a little more stringent in the long process, in actually allowing some of these drugs to be released, onto the final market. What may be happening in the end is that instead of developing extraordinary drug-resistant bacteria, we may end up getting to a stage where almost all other drugs are resistant. It's a concern I just want to raise, because as I look back in Africa, each drug that is released onto the markets and move into a program involves quite a lot of things. I mean, you have to change various systems, various programs, various delivery mechanisms. And I just wanted to sound a note of caution to all of us that probably in the area of TB, because of the development of multi-drug resistance and the other resistant patterns, we have to be probably a little more stringent before we release some of these drugs onto the market.
Thank you for sharing that concern. I don't know if any of the speakers want to address that. I can say briefly from the perspective of the TB Alliance, we share your concern about resistance developing to new drugs if they're released too quickly. Clearly, none of us believes that monotherapy should ever be prescribed for TB unless we can get down to truly short regimens, maybe 2 weeks or less, then one would reconsider that statement perhaps. But certainly for the foreseeable future, we're talking about developing novel regimens with novel, containing multiple drugs with novel mechanisms of action. And if possible, of course, I think most people would recommend development of fixed-dose combinations to ensure that patients are taking multiple effective drugs simultaneously to prevent development of resistance. I don't know if anyone else wants to add to that. Danny?
Can I just add to that? It's simply not true that drug resistance is increasing. If you go to well-run service programs, drug resistance is falling all the time, not increasing. The problem is how you actually use your current drugs. Misuse of those drugs is the problem. So I don't really think this is a real issue. I think we need new drugs because we want to make delivery easier and cheaper. And that's really the reason. Now, I wanted to comment on one or two points that have come up out of the talk. The first of this is about EBA studies, which, you know, I'm responsible in the main for developing EBA studies. What the results with the Johnson & Johnson drug show is that you actually need an initial EBA study that goes on with monotherapy with your new drug for about a fortnight. Now, this is a perfectly good ethical reason, ethical concept, because you're not going to use that drug in further treatment. And your control is standard treatment. If that had been done initially, and of course there was no reason to suppose that there would have been this curious lag, you see, if that had been done originally, we would now know whether the lower doses with J produced a fall in the CFU counts, but at a later date. So it's something that in thinking of new drug, we ought to start with a 14-day monotherapy with the new drug.
Should we let J&J yes. respond to that?
Yeah.
We tried to plan such a trial, and we were not able to get permission in South Africa to give more than 7 days, and that was a push. Maybe that climate will change, but that was our experience when we were conducting this trial.
I think that really points towards the short-sightedness of ethical committees, frankly, because there are two reasons for going on like this. Two reasons against it. An ethical committee says, well, drug resistance will develop. Well, it might. We don't know. But really, that doesn't matter, because it's not going to develop so quickly and so completely that treatment is ineffective. The second reason is that you might be giving them an ineffective drug over that 14 days. But actually, you've got to take that sort of risk at some point. Are you actually going to show that a drug is effective? The alternative is to go back after a 7-day trial and say we need to do it for longer. That's the alternative. But if you can get it for 14 days, try and push the medical committees, ethical committees, into being a bit more sensible. Now, the second point that I wanted to make, which I think is quite important, is this idea that you can test the action against non-multiplying dormant organisms by pushing a culture straight into anaerobiosis is really not a very useful idea. It was tried originally with PA824, and frankly, the results in mice certainly don't agree with it. It's also very unrealistic because, in fact, lesions must have an aerobic component, an anaerobic component, and probably components due to starvation, all sorts of other factors. You want an old culture as well as a young culture. But certainly, this bump into anaerobiosis really, I think, means nothing at all. So that was those two comments that I had.
Okay, thank you, Denny. Did any of the speakers want to address either of those points further? Okay, thank you.
So Professor Vakuzov, Moscow, Russia. I just want to make a little question to Dr. Edwards with his fascinating presentation about the inhaled capromycin. So as I have understood, this is one of the first new sites in the inhaled way of distribution of the remedies. And this, on the last ERS Congress in Munich, it was presented a work of the Exubera, the first inhaled insulin from Pfizer. And I just see some parallels between the Exubera inhaled insulin and your way of inhalation for capromycin. And just have some questions. The first, the main problem with Pfizer was that they could not obtain a consistency between different inhalations. The first, and it means that they in the advance they developed a special system for delivering the insulin. And the first question is, have you such system or this just a problem of the inhalation particles? Do you have the special system for delivering capromycin or it's just MDI? And the second question, do you know the way of how the capromycin goes in the alveolar tissue? For example, Pfizer doesn't know the way in which insulin goes through the membranes. The third question is about the concomitant diseases. For example, with Exubera, it was a real problem because when the man, for example, smokes, that leads for adverse events that insulin goes more rapid, and that means that this patient will have the hypoglycemia. And do you have some issues with that problem with concomitant diseases or with smoking, for example?
So I'm going to stand up in front of you since you have three questions. So the first question, about inhaled insulin. So clearly we've been inhaling drugs for 50 years or so, and actually antibiotics. And so tobramycin would be a much better comparison than inhaled protein like insulin. We have indeed, what happened with the inhaled insulin program is that Exubera or inhaled and Nektar developed their method for delivering because you couldn't overcome the forces without this special inhaler. And so our invention or whatever came up just after that to say, well, you know, people are used to a small inhaler, and so we developed particles that we could use a simple inhaler for. So the Eli Lilly is in late-stage clinical trials with a simple inhaler for the same. The issues with inhaled insulin are really very specific to, there are many that are very specific to insulin. They're specific to the fact that nobody ever done that before, and that there were, I'm not going to talk too much about that, but other than to say that there's some specific issues. It's also a lifelong therapy. In terms of inhaling antibiotics, it's gone on, and it is an improved kind of therapy. Where does capromycin go?
It is a question worth asking, but it's also worth asking for beta agonists and corticosteroids and other drugs that we deliver, including antibiotics to the lungs. It's an issue with insulin because particularly we're concerned about daily dosing and it's very low bioavailability. Here we have 70%, 60 or 70% bioavailability. So we know that 60 or 70% is going right into the systemic circulation, whereas with insulin it's 8%, so there's a bigger concern. Well, not to say that the new route of delivery, there's absolutely safety studies to do, and so those questions need to be answered.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Andy Vernon, CDC. Dr. Edwards, before you go, I'll do my questions in reverse order. I have three questions for three different speakers. For you, I was very interested in the differential efficacy in the lung and the spleen. I wondered if you looked at drug resistance, or since you're getting lower dose exposures systemically, I wondered if you've yet looked to see if you're creating resistance with those lower dose exposures.
No, we haven't. And I also want to point out, this, we just sort of guessed at what the dose should be. Clearly, you'd probably want to go higher, but you also would want to dose with other antibiotics.
Yeah,
but
sure.
We haven't looked at that yet.
And then for Dave McNeely, David, I just wondered, just to clarify, if that phase three design results in a successful trial, is the plan then to go for registration based on an MDR indication?
Well, I would say we don't regard this next trial as limiting us to MDR TB. We are still open. We're still early in development, but yeah. We think, given the information we presented, that that is an appropriate group of patients for us to get this kind of information.
In that regard, then, I would presume that you're already perhaps considering some discussions with regulatory agencies early in the process, since this is a little bit of a new design. It's a very promising one, but one that would be important for the TB community to become more familiar with, the HIV community is.
We have had discussions already with various concerned parties.
Great. And then for the Ofletub group, as I look at the Ofletub data and think back on how we got to this point of the interest in the fluoroquinolones generally, the initial Indian trial showed efficacy, indicated some efficacy and potential to shorten therapy. The adjusted Ofletub data shown today from the phase two did not demonstrate, in fact, it seemed to say there really was no difference in the efficacy of an ofloxacin supplemented regimen and a standard regimen. And I wondered in what way the Ofletub group thinks about those data in this consequently.
Christian, can you get to a microphone to address that, please?
Yes. What the SSCC study showed mainly is that the decline in log of selfie count was much more rapid when we join gatifloxacin or moxifloxacin replacement with ethambutol compared to the standard regimen of floxacin. So by obtaining such a steeper decline, there is a hope really that we can get a shortened treatment in duration. So that's mainly the duration that we are doing. Mm-hmm.
I know that this group is trying to publish those data and has had at least some difficulty getting them into a venue, and I'm very eager, as we all are, to see them. So anything that this group can do or to encourage journals in their contact with journals to make them aware of the importance of these kinds of data would be very helpful. I'd also like to support the point that Denny made about the importance of extending the EBAs. I've considered or thought about whether the groups doing EBAs should consider giving isoniazid for the first several days simply to get you onto the second curve, because it's really the second curve in which we're all, the second part of that bi-exponential curve in which we're all interested.
I think that is proof.
Danny, can I ask you to go to a microphone? Thank you. Yeah. You want to use this one? Danny?
I think the point is that if you extended the EBA study with monotherapy for 14 days, you would get some valuable information on the second part of the curve, on the persistent bacilli. The problem is the ethical issue, but I think that's been much overstated by ethical committees. The one thing you do not want to do is to start combinations in EBA studies, because as soon as you begin to do that, the sensitivity of the whole study contracts down and you get virtually nothing. You have to choose either monotherapy at the beginning, preferably for 14 days, or a whole 8-week study. I think that's a very important issue, because I know people are talking about extended EBA studies with combinations, and we are quite sure on good statistical evidence that that's not a practical possibility.
Lee?
Lee Reichman, New Jersey. Thanks for a terrific symposium. I just feel I need to comment on Denny Mitchison's, which I don't usually do, comment on a previous comment, in which, as he said, that drug resistance doesn't develop with well-run programs, and I agree 100%. But I think the problem is that the state of the art is not well-run programs, and I don't think we can forget that. Yes, we're making great progress with new drugs and things like that, but if we pay all our attention to new drugs, we're going to have more and more drug resistance occurring, and XDR, and all of these are man-made and wouldn't occur if we had well-run programs. So let's remember to pay attention to increase well-run programs.
Thank you.
Fraser Wares, WHO India. Giving a program question, I'm kind of, it's very exciting to hear new drugs are in the pipeline, but I'm kind of, certainly in India, the program in India is a well-run program because it is able to deliver supervised therapy by using a thrice-weekly intermittent regimen. Now, we've had discussions that a four-month daily regimen that needs to be supervised daily will actually increase patient-provider interactions by at least 2 or 3-fold compared to what the program is doing now with a cure rate of 85%. So my question is, are all the products in the pipeline looking at daily dosing, or is there evidence that some of these drugs could be given intermittently, like the drugs that we have today, which means a huge program treating 1.3 million patients a year is able to give supervised therapy? The other problem is that all these drugs will go straight into the private sector, as the quinolones in India are already being used for TB in the private sector, unsupervised.
David, do you want to address that?
Briefly, we do have possibilities with our compound to consider and look at intermittent dosing opportunities, and we plan on doing so.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that a number of the new compounds under development have relatively long half-lives and may have potential for intermittent dosing. And I think most of the sponsors are looking at that possibility as appropriate.
Jacques Rosset from John Hopkins. I would like to be one more supporting Danny Mitchison comments. You know, today is the feast of Danny. It's about EBA and the J compound, the Johnson & Johnson compound. I have two comments to make. First, I am 100% convinced the J&J compound is very active. And the second comment is EBA did not clearly demonstrate the potent activity that we can expect. So there is two possibilities. One, it's EBA. You know, EBA perhaps is not a good approach. And when we know that some extremely good drugs, like pyrazinamide, for example, has absolutely no EBA, that RIF or very poor EBA, which isn't, I say I agree with you, so don't say the opposite now. PCA is the poorest drug in the world. When you test it alone, it's almost, you know, very poor, but in combination it's marvelous, it's wonderful. And second, perhaps when you look at what has been published in the science for the J&J compounds, it's a drug with a time-dependent activity. And perhaps the short-term evaluation is not a good way to evaluate a drug. And that's my basic comment is, we should not have, it's exactly the opposite of what we would like, to have the royal way, the unique way to test a new compound. And I think more and more that does not exist. We should be very open-minded and find the good way to demonstrate, to exhibit the real quality of a new drug. And I am pushing my friend David McLeay to take initiative to have original ideas to find a good way to demonstrate that activity.
Wait, David, do you want to respond to that at all? I know Danny wants to respond to it. So.
Jacques was right when he said that over the first 2 days, pyrazinamide has no early bactericidal activity. But it's not true after that. After that, you get a decline in sputum CFU counts that goes at much the same rate as other drugs. Now, that still does not show you the quite unique way that pyrazinamide acts. I mean, pyrazinamide does not act in inhibiting an enzyme. It is not based on finding a site in the genome. If you go looking for drugs that inhibit enzymes, they will all stop working when you're dealing with fully dormant organisms. But pyrazinamide kills those that are completely dormant, you see. In fact, it kills them much better when they are completely dormant, because the pyrazinoic acid accumulates by passive diffusion into the cell and can only get out by an active pump. So it accumulates when the cell is completely dormant, and it kills by a physical process of acidification of the cell and destruction of membrane function. So this, in a sense, is saying that we shouldn't keep our drug discovery program focused solely on the genome, because actually pyrazinamide would never have been discovered that way. It is still a unique drug and will, I think, continue to be of increasing importance with drug development.
Over here, please.
Peter Omrod, UK. I'm a simple clinician. I've got a question for Dr. Edwards. His aerosol deposition slide showed very good deposition of aerosol in the lower and mid zones, but relatively less deposition in the upper zones. And as a clinician, I observe that tuberculosis is predominantly or usually an upper zone distribution disease. What about differential deposits in the lung, particularly in the upper zones? I accept you'll get a bloodborne level from wherever it's deposited, but if you're talking about getting most drug to the site of disease, there seems to be a potential mismatch between delivery and site of major disease.
Thank you. Thanks very much. One of the parameters that needs to be played with is the aerodynamic diameter. So we could deposit it all on the head or in the upper airways or the deeper lungs. And so that's true. The deposition data I showed you was particularly associated with development of deep lung deposition. But the aerosol that we delivered for Caprio had a more like a 4 micron MMAD. So although ultimately I think the right way to do this would be do
clinical studies with different MMADs. That's a good point.
All right, I think we have time for one last question. Kevin?
Yeah, I'll keep it short. Ann, I think this is for you, actually. So in follow-up to Denny Mitchison's comments, I suspect that many of us in this room feel that we're now spending way too much of our lives wrestling with IRBs or ethics review boards. And a suggestion or a plea is whether the alliance, or maybe better yet, the union, could come out with a statement to the effect that EBA studies over a 14-day period are safe. And in that way, you know, the IRBs in reality now are protecting themselves as much as our patients or our subjects. It's just the way it is. And in order for them to feel secure, if they had a document that they could go to from a well-established body, they could refer to that and say, okay, this is a safe thing to do.
It's an interesting idea, Kevin. I'm not sure that the Alliance is the right group to do it, but I think certainly whatever group might take that on, whether it's the Alliance or someone else, we'd need to pull together a group to really look at the literature, think about the ethics of the situation very carefully, look at the drug resistance data, and really think through the problem carefully before any statements were issued.
Thanks.
All right, I'd like to thank all the speakers very much and my co-chair, Dr. Narayanan, for certainly what I found to be an extremely interesting session. Thank you.
Thank you.